following episode contains language and descriptions of violence and self-harm. It may not be appropriate for all listeners, but it was my life. Discretion is advised.
My whole premise was, if Seth Ferrante is dead, they can't pursue a case. What I did is I faked my suicide. I was like, boom, if they don't find a body in 7 years,
case is done.
You know, like my parents can have me declared legally dead. As soon as I'm declared legally dead, then the fucking case is gone. They're not going to have a federal case against a fucking dead person. So that was my whole thing. I'm going to fake my suicide.
I'm your host, Peter Meyerhoff, and you're listening to the Roll Call with Chappie podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please subscribe, share, and follow us on social media. You can learn more about this episode and my mission at petermeyerhoff.com. All right, drop it. What up, what up, what up? Welcome back to another episode of Roll Call with Chappie, and I got a superstar in the studio with me today. If you don't know who he is, Seth Ferrante, producer of White Boy on Netflix, and I'm actually going to let him tell him about himself. So thank you for being here, Seth. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Kind of like the self-styled outlaw filmmaker, you know, ex-con, did like 21 years, started writing books, in the pen, and now I do film, man. You know, I did White Boy, wrote and produced that, and I appeared in it as a talking head. It's on Netflix right now. It tells the story of White Boy Rick, you know, and the police corruption and injustice that occurred to him in his case, like in the mid-80s in the crack era in Detroit.
And I watched that movie, and we watched it back-to-back two nights in a row, and that movie is nuts. I mean, his story is crazy. The movie was put together. It's just insane. It was an awesome movie. Like I said, I watched and I wanted to watch it over again, but I had to go to bed that night. So let's get into a little bit before then, because obviously you have knowledge in that past. So growing up, what were you doing? Because you were an outlaw. So tell the people how you grew up.
Yeah, I got into drugs probably like 13, man, you know, pretty early, you know. And I don't know. I was just looking. I was looking for something. I don't know, something that wasn't inside myself. You know, I was a military brat, so I moved around a lot. I was always kind of like the new guy. So, you know, I think I just found, like, with drugs, like, when you become the drug guy, the party guy, and eventually, you know, the drug dealer, you know, people just recognize you, you know, a lot sooner, you know? So I had that, whatever it was about me, you know, if I was insecure, if I was this or that, you know, I wanted to be known, I wanted to be recognized, and moving around a lot, I was insecure a lot growing up. So, you know, always be put in new situations, having to make new friends, you know, eventually, like, when you get in junior high and high school, like new girlfriends. So I was just always kind of searching for that. And for me, the drugs, it kind of like, you know, made me that guy, you know, first as, you know, smoking weed, you know, like seventh grade, you know, because not a lot of people were smoking weed in seventh grade. So I was like, you know, that dude kind of stepping out there, you know, the bold, the brash one, you know. And then eventually getting drugs, you know, from my friends, you know, turning people onto it. And then, you know, eventually selling drugs, where when you start selling drugs in a high school atmosphere, you become very popular very quick, and everybody kind of knows who you were. And
it's the high school shot caller.
Yeah, I mean, it's like being the rock star, you know. Yeah. I don't know, whatever it was about me, I always wanted to be like that rock star type of dude. So, you know, it just advanced, like 13, you know, using, you know, 14 scoring for me and my friends, you know, 15 kind of trying to figure out, like, hey, I can make some money on this and free drugs. Free, you know, drugs, this just ain't free drugs. I can make some money on this. And, you know, then 16, 17, 18, start establishing a network, you know, with, you know, plugs, connections, you know, people at colleges, you know, eventually when I graduated out of high school and my friends did, you know, kind of taking the trade and what we were doing there. So it was kind of like a gradual progression over a number of years.
I'm glad you say that, because I, you know, I always say that a lot of people start younger, and it's usually they're missing something in their lives, whether it's insecure, they don't have the right family at home, or they're just around some bad peer pressure dudes, you know. So it's always the same kind of circle there. So you started getting into building a little empire though, right?
Yeah, so I went to this real big high school called Robinson, had like 4,000 people in Fairfax, Virginia. And, you know, when we had just moved there, we moved there when I was, you know, basically like probably like 16, 17 years old. And as everybody kind of graduated and went off to college, you know, because when I got there, you know, I was like, whatever, you know, like 16, 17, 10th, 11th grade. So I was telling to everybody. So it was like those seniors go off to college. You know, then they're like, hey, man, why don't you come up and party, you know, and bring some of that good Cali bud, or, you know, bring some of those LSD or bring some of those shrooms or whatever. So I would start going up there and I would start planning these little trips. And at first, maybe, you know, I just took a little, you know, kind of test in the waters. But then like a couple of times I had like really good success. Like I like sold out.
Really?
Yeah. So then I would, you know, take more and it just became this thing like kind of have drugs, will travel. And, you know, by the time I was 19, I was basically supplying like 15 colleges with weed and LSD in five states.
Wow. How do you feel now knowing that weed's legal? Because you went away for weed charges eventually too, right?
Yeah, I look at it like now, like I always tell people, I never consider myself a criminal, right? I consider myself an outlaw because I broke laws that I thought were wrong. So I always thought weed and hallucinogens, you know, psychedelics should be legal. You know, I always classified them to me like the righteous drugs. You know, I was never into, I'm not an amphetamine dude. So I was never in, you know, the coke and never got into heroin. I never got into heroin because I had friends that did heroin and I was like, because I'm like a downer, dude. I like downers and psychedelics. So I saw some of my dudes get strung out. Like some dudes that when I was like 16, like these dudes were like in their 20s. Like they were like my idols. I was getting drugs from them. And then they got strung out on heroin. So I found out like 16, 17, I was like, don't fuck with heroin.
Stay away from that shit. Yeah.
You know, but yeah, but definitely. I mean, I thought weed should be legal the whole time. So for me, I mean, I don't feel any kind of way, whatever, you know, we all got our cross to bear, you know, we all got what we got to go through to make who we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a knucklehead. So whatever, I had to do 21 years to transform me into the person I am now. But, you know, I'm cool. But yeah, I don't feel any kind of way that I did that time. The only thing I would say on that tip is I think like a lot of the people in the industry, I mean, whatever, this is America, it's capitalism. Everybody can fucking make money. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of those people that are in the industry that don't have any roots in the culture, you know, nobody's saying you got to give the culture money, but recognize, man, just, you know, pay homage to the people that, you know, for, you know, the last 50 years, you know, going back to the 70s. You know, we're growing the weed so we could even have weed to smoke. And in the 80s, you know, because a lot of people laid the roots for this industry. And some people, even ex-law enforcement people, come into the industry, invest a lot of money, or politicians or whatever. And whatever, make your money, man. But, you know, pay respect to the people that came before you, you know. Yeah. And if you can, you know, get some of their weed in your dispensary, you know, if the regulations are right, you know, do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's all I say. You know, as long as the product's good. I mean, of course.
That's right. So did you, when you end up going away, did they bust down your whole little organization that you had going as a youngster? Or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Because that's a really interesting story too.
Yeah, pretty much. Dude, almost everybody I knew pretty much snitched on me, basically.
That's how it goes.
I mean, it was like the feds, dude. Like I was like that first wave. Like they just made those laws, the mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines, like, you know, around 88. Uh-huh. And at first they were just, you know, I mean, they were basically, you know, targeting all the African-Americans in the inner city because, you know, because of crack.
Yeah.
You know, but then after they did that for like, you know, 3 or 4 years, you know, they started filling up the prisons. You know, there was a lot of outcry, you know, and rightly so, you know, because that was like, you know, targeting people racially. That's fucked up. So then around 91 to kind of act the government, you know, the DEA to kind of act the feds like, oh, we just don't target black people. They started moving out to the suburbs.
We'll get Seth too.
Yeah. 91. I was like that first wave, dude. Wow. I was in the first wave when they first went out to the suburbs and started targeting marijuana and LSD people.
Okay.
So, you know, really at that time, I didn't even know about the mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines, for sure. And even the fucking war on drugs, dude. I was like in my nice little suburban cocoon.
Yeah.
You know, I knew tons of dudes that sold weed and LSD and had been doing it for like for 10 fucking years.
Like nothing.
Yeah. Like nothing, man. Like forming businesses and blowing up off of, you know, basically weed or LSD money. And, yeah, but whatever, man, shit happened. You know, they cracked me in the head, but you know, I took off. I made matters worse, you know, my behavior and stuff and what I did. But, yeah, man, this all, you know, it's kind of like with the feds, man, it's fucked up with the feds because I mean, you're going to target people, you know, for a plant, but any drugs, man, because most of the people that went to jail for the war on drugs were basically entrepreneurs. You know, some were violent. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, violence, you know, doesn't really have a big place in our society. So like a lot of times they put violent people in prison, but, you know, they were putting a lot of us drug dealers in prison just because we were kind of basically making money like outside the normal means and not paying taxes on it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so I think that's, you know. And I think plus all the stuff that was going down in Colombia, you know, Pablo Escobar, narco terrorism, that really played a big effect on the war on drugs in this country.
They're probably trying to get ahead of it, they thought, huh?
The people in control want to stay in control.
Yeah, for sure. So initially, when you got finally arrested, what were your charges and what did they catch you with?
I didn't get caught with anything.
Wow.
So other people got caught with stuff.
With your product.
And said it was mine.
Okay.
And I mean, it was mine.
For sure. So what they initially charge you with?
I got first I got arrested on a state case.
Okay.
For a conspiracy to distribute LSD.
Okay.
And then when they found out, they did some investigating and dudes started flipping. So they found out like basically all my stuff was coming from California. So then they pushed it federal. You know, they brought in like a DEA liaison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they pushed the state, pushed the case federal. You know, so then I got reindicted by the feds, and I got a CCE charge, like a continual criminal enterprise.
Damn.
Like it's basically like a RICO Act kingpin charge, 848.
And you're like, I'm a suburban kid.
Yeah, and it carries 20 to life. So I was like, what the fuck? So
went from being a high school just dealing drugs and stuff to looking at a 20
years
old.
20 years old. That's what I was facing, dude. I was 20. So you know, at the time, I thought I was, like, real smart. So, like, I had a little bit of money. So, I took the fuck off. I was like, man, fuck that. I'm not doing 20 to life.
Yeah.
And basically, with the feds, even at that time, it was like, okay, go to trial, face 20 to life. Or they try to do, like, plea bargains. You know, but a lot of the plea bargains, like, they want you to turn, you know.
On
like,
everybody, yeah.
Like, they even told me. They told me, like, oh, you can do, we'll give you, like, 5 years, you know. But they want me to, like, set people up, bring people in from San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, do deals. And, like, they're like, you know, I'm like, fuck that.
Didn't consider it, even looking at 20 to life?
Nah. I mean, you know, when your lawyer tells you, you listen.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, I was like, man, I don't know. Because to me, it's about, you got to be able to look yourself in the mirror in the morning. You know, whatever. I'm not knocking whatever. People do what they got to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm not upholding no criminal code or death before dishonor or none of that shit. Because you know a lot of that shit's garbage anyhow.
Hell yeah.
But you know, but definitely, man, for me, you know, I gotta look myself in the mirror. So whatever. If I get in trouble, you know, even if it's somebody else's fault, you know, I'm gonna take what comes. I'm not gonna put it off on somebody else. I'm gonna carry my own burden.
Yeah.
You know, because to me that's what being a man is. You know, it's carrying your own burden and you know, providing for those that depend on you.
And then another thing I learned about you too, and I was watching when they had that case that was on the news, I feel like you were on TV every single day. You had went on the run and faked your own death, right?
Yeah. So my whole premise was, if Seth Ferrante is dead, they can't pursue a case. What I did is I faked my suicide. I was like, boom, if they don't find a body in 7 years,
case is done.
You know, like my parents can have me declared legally dead. As soon as I'm declared legally dead, then the fucking case is gone. They're not going to have a federal case against a fucking dead person. So that was my whole thing. I'm going to fake my suicide.
How'd you do it?
Well, that's what I did. When I was growing up, well, not growing up, but like, you know, I was always a big sports fan. And so back then it was like newspapers. So, you know, every day we'd get the newspaper and I'd go right to the sports section. And, you know, right in front of the sports section was usually the metro section, you know, for the DC papers. And I just remember sometimes, you know, a lot of times the headline on the metro might catch me before I got to the sports section. And Great Falls, where I faked my suicide, I remember ever since I was like 16, 17 and first moved in that area, there'd always be these like, you know, people commit suicide, you know, teen jumps to his death, you know, or, you know, elderly pensioner, you know, jumps in the water and drowns. And it was just like this place where it seemed like a lot of people were committing suicide. So when I came up with this idea, that was like, you know,
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I'm gonna fake my suicide here. This is like, you know, so I went to this place, Great Falls, and it's like class 5 rapids, you know, it's like, and it's all rocks and like, you know, like raging river waters. And so even if you jump in the water, you know, if you can't swim, so you're gonna get smashed against the rock. So it's basically like a guaranteed death, you know, if you jump in.
Yeah.
So I went there, you know, I planned it all out. I like staged a scene. you know, I even jumped out like on the path, you know, and I saw like a couple and I was like, my friend jumped.
Oh no.
You know, and then like I ran off.
Yeah.
You know, and left them to like report it. And I had like my ID and all that stuff. And I took off and I went to LA, got on a plane, went to LA. And I was going down, you know, I was staying at Point Magoo on a military base with this girl. Her dad was like XO of the base. And so I was staying at their house, but every day we would drive down 101 and go into LA because we'd go get the newspapers. Because back then they had all the newspaper stands, you know, this is like pre-internet.
Yeah.
So I'd go get the internet, the paper, and I would read like the Washington Post. And I would read, and like first I saw the headline in the Metro. It was like Fairfax County LSD kingpin commit suicide. And I was like, happy as fuck. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, it worked.
You know, because I was like, dude, I was like 20. You know, I'm planning all this shit. Like, I'm fucking James Bond. On the fly, too,
yeah.
Yeah, like I'm James Bond and some shit. I don't know if I'm going to pull it off or not. So I see that, and I'm like, I pulled it off. I was like fucking elated, man. You know, like in my little fucking outlaw fucking mind, counterculture mind. Like, yeah. I thought I was like fucking whatever. You know, fucking, you know, I was like Jim Morrison or fucking Hunter S. Thompson or the fucking, that dude that stole all that money and jumped off the airplane. I can't even think of his name.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so I thought, you know, I was like all this. And so I kept going because I wanted to read because I knew some of my co-defendants were going to trial like soon. So we kept going down there. And eventually, like 2 weeks after we went down there and I got a Washington Post and it said that the prosecutors, you know, declared my suicide a hoax.
It was after 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks. And I was like crushed because I made all these fucking plans, dude. And my plan was just like, boom. Like I was like on fucking the top of the world.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, fuck, what happened to my plan, dude? My plan is fucking garbage. You know, they didn't go for it. And so I started reading the article because I was like, where did I fuck up?
Yeah.
You know, because I think I'm like this little super fucking smart kid, you know, fucking whatever.
What'd they say?
Super genius. And, yeah, so I'm reading it and it said, you know, they dragged the river for 2 weeks and they didn't find a body. And they said in that part of the river, they always found a body.
Gotcha.
Because like a mile down, there was like a dam.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I did, I fucked up. I did it on the wrong side of the dam. Man.
No way.
Yeah, fucking dumbass.
It was all part of the plan though. But yeah. Dang. So how did you finally get caught?
Well, shit, it was at the
Because you were top 10 most wanted on the FBI's list or something,
yeah,
weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, they made me top 15 U.S. Marshals.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's another story itself because the dude...
Let's hear it.
So there's this dude, his name was Henry Hudson. He was not the head prosecutor, but he was like the assistant prosecutor, you know, in the Eastern District of Virginia, you know, the assistant federal prosecutor. And so... I guess like I was a little kid. I mean, because I was a little kid from the suburbs, so they probably thought I was like a gold mine. Like I was gonna, you know, because most white roll kids back then, yeah, would from the suburbs would roll on everybody. So they probably saw me as a gold mine. And like when I took off, it kind of left a black mark on his record. So this dude Hudson goes from the federal prosecutor's office all of a sudden to the head of the U.S. Marshal's office. And when he goes, he does all the paperwork to make me top 15. Because, wow. Dude, I didn't carry a gun. I wasn't violent. Yeah. I was anything. And I'm like top 15 U.S. fucking marshals list. And even the whole time I was a fugitive for 2 years, I had no fucking no clue. I had no idea. Until like when I got caught and they fucking started acting like I was somebody special. But
you're like, dude, I'm just Seth Ferranti. What are you guys doing?
And even the whole time I was selling, I was selling weed the whole fucking time. I was a fugitive. You know, I had like different names. I had different IDs and stuff. But I basically like started another, you know, I went out to California. I was out there for 6 months. I had maybe like 30 grand. And I spent all that shit in 6 months, you know, mm-hmm. trying to be the big dude. You know, like I was still a fucking big drug dealer when I didn't have any money coming in. So then I went to Texas and I hooked up with this dude, Mexican Eddie. He was like my old weed connect.
Okay.
He used to run truckloads of weed up from Matamoros into, you know, Houston and Dallas. So I hooked up with him and I started selling weed down there in Texas. But, you know, like that time, it's like weed was cheap in Texas. I mean, it's like $500 a pound.
A pound, yeah.
You know, we're talking like 91, 92. And I couldn't make any money down there selling weed. You know, so I met this dude from St. Louis and I started hauling weed from Dallas, Texas up to St. Louis. And I kind of had like my second little run. You know, that was like my second little run. It was only about 10 months, but, you know, like I started making, you know, decent money, not as much as before, but I was still making, you know, cause you get like $1,000 markup, sometimes $800, $900 a pound.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I'm taking 50 to 100 pounds up there.
Every month or what?
Sometimes two, 3 months, you know?
Okay.
But, you know, I'm making fucking, you know, $800, $900 a pound. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, do the math even on 50 pounds.
For sure.
We're talking fucking 92. So.
And you're what, 21 at this time?
Yeah, 21, 22. Yeah.
Damn.
So. But, yeah, so eventually, you know, I got caught. I got arrested. It was some bullshit, just like some happenstance shit.
No way.
You know what I'm saying? Where we were smoking a joint in the back of this fucking Burger King. And they fucking called the cops on us.
No, and they
called the cops on us. Yeah, like we're just in the parking lot smoking fucking weed. And we had just ate in the fucking Burger King, too.
Did you try to give them one of the other IDs, or did you not have it with you?
No, I had it, but they arrested me because the dude that I was with, it was his car, and actually he sold weed for me, but he had a half pound of weed in the truck that, you know, I didn't even know was there. Like, I was, you know, we're going out to party. It's like, why the fuck you got a half pound of weed in the truck? But
yeah,
whatever. So they arrest us. You know, he claims it. But they already arrested us, you know, printed me. You know what I'm saying? So they released me because he said it, he copped to it, said it was his. And then fucking I go bail him out, you know, get his car out of impound. And yeah, but they matched my prints, dude. So they matched my prints up in like fucking 3 fucking days, dude. And like the whole time I was a fugitive.
So then they know you're in Texas, huh?
Yeah. It was in St. Louis.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, in the NCIC, like the National Crime Index Center. So I'm watching, as a fugitive, I'm watching all the shows. Dude. I'm watching like America's Most Wanted, like Unsolved Mysteries, because, you know, I'm a fugitive. So I'm thinking like, how long does it, you know, take? I'm trying to like do some research.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I saw like serial killers and shit. It took them like 3 to 6 months to match up their prints. Right. And then like me fucking hippie fucking weed fucking psychedelics dealer, like they matched my prints up in 3 days. Yeah. You know, and then like they were on me in St. Louis because they were on that dude. They had his real name, even though I was under fake ID. And, like, they went to his house. They went to his grandparents' house. Like, fucking, it was, like, a big mess.
And he probably rolled on you?
Well, his grandparents convinced him to turn himself in, you know, and then he fucking cooperated. You know, he started taking him around to all the people that sold weed for me. And, like, eventually they found somebody and they took him right to the hotel room I was at.
Damn. Okay, so did you end up signing for the 20 to life, or what did you end up getting on that case?
No, I got, I got 25 when they took me back to Virginia. In December 1993, and they gave me, I got 292 months. You know, the feds do it by months.
The feds do it by months, that's weird.
So I got 292 months, and then they indicted me on more charges, another 4-count indictment, right, for like, because I had like 21 different IDs when they found me. You know, all legitimate IDs through like DMVs that I had got.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so they did, but they didn't even have identity theft back then, right? So this is like 93, no identity theft, right? So I got mail fraud.
Really?
Yeah. They charge, you know, because a lot of the addresses, you got to mail it to an address.
Yeah.
You know? So even though they don't give you the ID, they just give you a little paper, you know, and then they mail it. So I got mail fraud. And then I got, I got a fraudulent use of ID. So I pled guilty. It was like 4-count indictment, like obstruction of justice and like, you know, absconding or whatever. So I pledged 2 counts, and then they only gave me 12 months for those 2 counts because it's like little minor, you know, white collar shit.
Yeah.
But they tacked that shit on to the 292.
Consecutive?
Yeah, they ran that shit consecutive. Damn. So look, these motherfuckers, first, like they fucking beat my ass, punched me in the face, kicked me while I was down, cracked my head open with 292. And then they fucking brought me back and fucking bitch slapped me and gave me fucking 12 more months. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? Like, are you serious? Like, I'm fucking so dangerous. Like, never carried a gun. You know, I'm not going to say I never got in fights, but I wasn't like a dude going around beat people down and
yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, they just fucking fucked me up. So I had, I was basically 22 and I had 304 months, which is 25 years, 4 months in the feds. And in the feds, you got to do 85%.
Yeah, that's what they do in Arizona. Damn, so 25 years at 22. And then for that case, I would have been one angry dude. What are your thoughts going to prison at that young age for all that time?
Yeah,
do you remember?
I mean, really, dude, I was almost like, I was angry, but I'm the type of dude, like, my anger kind of has to simmer. You know what I'm saying? So I got to, like, think about shit. So, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, I grew to be a real, very, very angry young man. You know, my first fucking 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of prison. But, you know, really at first, I think I was more shocked.
For sure.
Because first I was like, man, I'm selling weed and LSD. And I'm like, dude, like this is supposed to be my country. And like my country just gives me like fucking whack 25.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I didn't consider what I did, you know, that bad at all, dude. I didn't kill anybody or do like some type of heinous act or, you know, like you would think like somebody would get 25 years, you know, because that was right in the beginning when they started giving drug dealers that type of time.
Murder, I mean, they get that.
Yeah. So it was just like, it was a crazy time. It was the war on drugs era. I mean, you know, I'm glad now it seems like we're coming out of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely, man, fucked up. Like, so I was really like, really, I was almost like in shock, like felt betrayed by my country. I was like, you know, what the fuck?
How dare you do this in the USA, huh?
Yeah. You know, I mean, but true too. I mean, I was an entitled white person. I mean, I'm not going to lie. So,
yeah,
you know, I grew up in the suburbs, you know, I was an entitled white person. I was like, well, how the fuck can you do this to me? You know, but they fucking did it to me, you know, for whatever reason, you know, to make it seem like my own government, to make it seem like they weren't racist or whatever, you know, because all the laws were targeting blacks. So, you know, they had to go get some, you know, white drug dealers too.
Damn. So I know the feds are real different from the state, and I'm very open that I did nothing but politic and do bad stuff the entire time I was in prison. You chose the other route. So you got into a lot of positive stuff in prison. Tell a little bit about how it was doing that 25 years and what you got into there and how you even started getting into that. Because that's pretty intense.
Yeah. So when I first, you know, I started out like level 3 yards. So like medium highs, you know, in the feds, they call them gladiator schools. Mm-hmm. So I did my first 12 years in the gladiator schools. And it's like, dudes aren't really getting stuck, you know, sometimes every now and then, but you know, it's not like they're doing it in like the level four, the maxes, like when yep. they're, you know, that's what they say. Like in the USPs, the level fours in the feds, they say boys fight, men kill.
Yeah.
You know, in the gladiator schools, you got to fight.
Yep.
You know, dudes get stuck, but you know, they just poke dudes like, you know, whatever, 2, 3, 4 times. Not like, you know, the level four, like they're stabbing dudes.
Trying
like,
to kill people.
They're like 60 times.
Stabbing you in the head and everything. Yeah, for sure.
Like you're not playing.
Literally, you know, right in your eyes.
That's what they say. Boys fight, men kill.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I had to fight a lot, but really I kind of found my, you know, cause it's like anything and like, you know, the same, it's your own people. It's not like when you go in prison, it's not like different races.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to prey on you, you know, or beat you up or it's like your own people. They basically give you a heart check. Like, you know, you fight or you're basically, you know, like food.
Yeah, literally.
You know, so, you know, so I had to go in that. Luckily, I was always been, you know, kind of tall. So I was like 6'1", but when I first went, I was probably, you know, I was like 22. So I was probably only like 175, 185.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got on the weights pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, within my first year, I started working out. And then I kind of found a refuge. You know, when I went in the feds back then, they offered college courses. They used to have like teachers come right from, I was in Manchester, Kentucky.
Okay.
And so they had the teachers, instructors coming right from Eastern Kentucky University would come right on the compound at night, you know, and like take like, you know, extra jobs, like overtime or whatever.
Okay.
And so I fell right into that. They had Pell Grants. You didn't have to pay for it. But so my first 2 years, I kind of fell into that. And I was always real athletic. So I played a lot of sports.
Yeah.
I was always a white dude out there. Like, look, I was running ball with all the black dudes.
Same.
I was playing soccer with all the Mexicans, you know, and it's still, you know, hanging out with my own people. I mean, because you pretty much got to hang out, you know, your skin color is your tribe in there.
For sure.
Your flag or, you know, whatnot. But I really found a refuge in kind of education, doing the educational stuff. And really, before I got on drugs, I mean, I was really like a really academic, you know, I was like straight A,
honor roll student. Smart.
You know, and then 13, I got into drugs. I kind of fell off, you know, with my school. So I kind of embraced that stuff. And two, at the same time, like at 22, dude, like I built my whole world from the age of whatever, 15, 16, on being like this drug dealer, you know, type of dude. Like, this is who I was, you know, and I liked being that person at the time. I wanted to be that person. That was what I wanted to be. You know, like Tony Montana was like a hero of mine.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, in prison, everybody cheers for the bad guy. But, you know, I flirted with like that. You know, I romanticized like that outlaw stuff. So I was who I wanted to be at that time. But then when that's all taken away from you, like that, and you're like nothing, but, you know, like in the feds, like you don't even have a name in the feds. In the feds, you're a fucking number.
Yeah.
You know, I was 18205083. So they just take all that fucking shit from you and you're like nothing and basically strip you down. And so, you know, that first couple of years, I was trying to figure out like who the fuck I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only do I have to figure out who I was, you know, but I got to do it in kind of like this harsh environment where, like, if you don't fight, like, you're exposed as a chump, and people, you know, basically, you know, turn predatory against you.
Yeah,
you know
sure.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I say, not the most ideal environment, but whatever, you know, my big thing was, like, I'm a big researcher, you know, I'm kind of academic in a way. So when I first got in.
What were you taking at first? What classes? Do you remember?
Just all the basics.
Just whatever,
like,
they had.
Freshman stuff. Yeah. A lot okay. of freshman stuff, like English, you know, politics, you know, maybe like some algebra 2, geometry, like yeah. most things freshmen would take. But, you know, also at the same time, when I'm doing this stuff and I'm trying to figure out who I was, you know, I had my mom get me a lot of books, and this kind of inspired my writing too, because I needed to learn about prison. So, you know, I was learning about prison firsthand, but, you know, I'm a cerebral type of person. So I like to read, I like to gain a bunch of different knowledge, and then I like to implement the knowledge, like, with my own plan. So I started reading, like, all these like classic, prison, you know, nonfiction books, like, In the Belly of the Beast, Jack Henry Abbott, Soledad Brother, George Jackson,
okay.
Live from Death Row, Mumia Abdul-Jamal, you know, just all these different books, anything my mom could find. And in a lot of ways, you know, these kind of became like a blueprint, you know, on how to survive in prison, you know, with what I was learning firsthand, you know, gave me maybe a little bit of outside knowledge. But at the same time, reading these other prison writers inspired me, because I was like reading their stories, and they're like different systems. Like Jack Henry Abbott was like New York system in the 70s, you know, George Jackson was like California system in the 60s, you know, and it was like super racial. And I mean, the feds were racial, but the feds, they were not, like, some of the stuff I was reading, the feds weren't that racial.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. It was a lot more laid back than like some of the stuff I was reading, you know. But you know, these kind of gave me like a ground and kind of like a you know, worldview of prison that I could use with what I was learning to kind of implement. But also it gave me, you know, the inspiration, you know, to tell my own story, because I was like, you know, the life I was living in prison wasn't the same life that these people were talking about. So I was like, let me write my, you know, my vision, let me write what I'm learning. And the dude, this was like in the first 2 years, like this kind of gelled in as I was taking these college courses, as I was educating myself, as I was learning how to write, you know, improve my grammar and all that stuff. Because, you know, I mean, I went to high school. I was a smart kid and everything. But, you know, still, if you want to do something well, I mean, you have to put years and years, you know, in learning the craft. So
yeah.
That's how I kind of use the college courses. And eventually, like, they abolished the Pell Grants in the Fed. So, like, they took all the college systems out. Like, I just got in there, was taking it for, like, 2 years, and they abolished it all. And I was like, fuck, I was kind of back to square one. But I got, like, straight A's. And also that first 2 years, I was kind of repairing the relationship with my parents,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I mean, I fucked that up, you know,
for
with
sure.
drugs and all the shit I was doing. And then, you know, like all that shit happened. I mean, that was like a big embarrassment to them, you know, so I kind of had to like repair that relationship. But, you know, with the education and getting the good grades and sending them that and giving them that consistent report.
That you were trying.
Yeah, it kind of made them see, okay, well, he fucked up. He's in a bad situation. He did this all to himself. You know, because that's what they were saying at the time. You know, in retrospect, they can look back and say, oh, yeah, the government was kind of targeting this shit. But, you know, when it's happening in the moment, you know, everybody's, you know, selling you that that line, like, whatever. Like you said, weed's legal now. But, like, back then, it was like weed was, like, fucking heroin.
Yeah.
And, like, I was, like, fucking everybody's telling me how wrong I was and what a drug addict I was and all this type of shit like this. But luckily, I did that little record of grades for 2 years. I had that opportunity. And then I showed that to my parents, and I told them I wanted to continue my education. And so they actually funded it, like
no way,
for correspondence
cool.
courses. And they found me courses from, you know, because I got my associates from Penn State.
Okay, well.
I got my bachelor's from University of Iowa, and I got my master's degree from California State.
Master's degree?
Yeah, so I got all, like, through credit, all through correspondence, and all, like, writing heavy, like, creative. You know, like my master's degree, I mean, it was in humanities, but it was like a lot of film stuff. So
yeah.
I kind of had this vision like 2 years in. I was like, I want to become a writer. And then as I learned more, like through the college, and the college courses too, like most time people, like out here, like a master's degree, a BA and a master's degree is like 6 years. But, you know, I stretched that shit out, you know, because I was only doing maybe like 12 credits a year, you know, because I'm in the fucking madhouse. It's not like the most perfect place to fucking study. Like study and shit. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, dude, that's what my wife says to this day. She tells me, like, I want everything chaotic all around me. I want the TV on. I want this on. I want everything. I want the chaos all around me because then I can focus.
Yeah.
It's like I need the chaos. If I'm just like me in a room and it's quiet, I can't focus because I'm not used to that shit. I learned to focus, you know, in the chaos.
That's right.
But yeah, I stretched my college career. I mean, I didn't even get my master's like 2010. So, you know, you're talking 1973. You're talking 17 years.
Damn. Okay. And then what'd you start writing at first?
So I first started writing, you know, I got a job in prison. You know, everybody, you know, you got to get some bullshit job. So, a lot, you know, I played sports and a lot of my homies, like they worked in recreation. They ran the sport leagues, the intramural sport leagues. So I started doing like the stats. You know, okay. I'd be like the dude keeping the books. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so then as doing that, I started compiling the stats and doing like a newsletter. You know, you put out like, you know, the top five scores or top five batting average, most home runs, wow. You know, shit like that. Like in record, they put on the bulletin boards. And then as I was doing that, a lot of dudes from other joints were coming and they were like, hey man, like, why don't you do like a write-up? And I was like, well, what the fuck you mean? And, you know, they would show me like little sports newsletters from like other joints that people had done, you know? So then I went to the rec dudes and I kind of pitched that. So, you know, I think I was taking at the same time, I was taking like some article writing classes, like okay. in my college classes. So I was like, you know, so really for like 6 years, that was what I did. My first summer, basically from 93 to 99, I was writing like in the prisons. You know, I was doing like the sports newsletters. Like I even used to do for the soccer, and then they would have this program. They would translate my writing to Spanish.
Oh no way!
Yeah, for all the Spanish dudes. Okay. And like, and you know, like stuff like that in prison. Like dudes, when they get mentioned, they like want copies. They want to send them home. You know, because anything you can do positive, send you for your family. It's like good in there.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I'm saying? Because there's so much negativity, and so that's how I first started writing. And eventually when I started doing stuff for like, you know, like they started having like a lot of like prison advocacy groups, like Families Against Mandatory Minimum, November Coalition, you know, different. These were like national ones for the feds. I'm sure okay. like in Arizona, they had like different ones, you know, a writing program. So I started writing stuff and send it to them. And sometimes they would print them in these little newsletters, you know, and I would like get a kick out of it or whatever, you know, cause feel like you did something positive, something yeah. in the real world. You know, above and beyond, you know, where you're at and what you're doing. So eventually, like around 99, I just done basically like newsletters and that writing on the compound for the sports stuff. But I was in Fort Dix in 99 in New Jersey, this federal prison in New Jersey, real big. It was like 3,000 people. Yeah. And their sports leagues were like awesome.
Oh, I bet.
Like it was like when the basketball dudes played, because a lot of New York dudes.
Oh.
So they had that Rutger Park game. So and Fort Dix was on a military base.
Wow.
So we had like a real gym, you know, with like bleachers, almost like a high school type gym with wood floors. And the games were like off the hook, man. They would be huge. So I was writing stuff, and I'd been writing like 6 years this time in there. And some dudes from Harlem, I was writing about this one dude named Ron Jordan from Harlem. And he like had this badass game, you know, they called him Ron Jordan the Abuser, because he would score like 60 points a game. Dude was just like phenomenal, right? And he wasn't even that big. He was like built like an NFL linebacker or something, a running back, you know,
yeah.
probably like, you know, 6 foot, 225, you know, but he would like kill him with the threes, you know, dunk, everything. He had all the dribble stuff. So I was like writing all this stuff about him. And some of his homeboys from Harlem, they came and they saw, and they were like, they're like, what, were you a professional writer on the street? I was like, no, I just started this shit in here. And they were like, well, our homeboy from Harlem got this magazine called Don Diva that he started while he was in prison. And Don Diva was kind of like the, you know, they would interview like all the gangsters, the top gangsters, you know, from the crack era, you know, like the mid 80s into the mid 90s, you know, from like New York, you know, DC, Philly, like any of the big cities. But these were guys that were kind of like as gangster rap came around and hip hop, like in the mid 90s, these were like the guys that were kind of lionized in the lyrical lore of hip hop and gangster rap. Mm-hmm. And so, dude started this magazine based on that, like from the feds, and he got out and they wanted me to write about this guy, Ron Jordan, for the magazine. So they hooked me up with him and I started doing, this was kind of like my first kind of like little success writing. I started doing these pieces for him. I did the Ron Jordan piece and I started doing these other pieces and I started like interviewing gangsters because I found out like on a lot of the compounds I was on, there was like all these dudes, you know, all these gangsters. I mean, there was a lot of mafiosos, Colombianos, but also like the African-American gangsters. And when I started looking into it, like a lot of the Italian guys all had books about them. A lot of the Colombian cartel dudes had a lot of books about them. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these African-American dudes, you know, there might be newspaper articles about them, but there were no books or no articles, magazine articles. And this dude kind of came in and kind of filled this niche. And I started writing and I just started cranking out stuff for him. Cause I mean, I was like right there with all the people.
Yeah.
You know, he like the dude, you know, once he got out, him and his wife, they'd be like, well, what do you got? You know, I'd be like, I mean, I'm like, you know, it was like a perfect place to be, you know, kind of write true crime.
Yeah. Instead of slang drugs, you're selling articles now. Right. So you had, we were both on Vice's show. I was a teenage felon. You were season one and you were the finale. You had eventually started writing for Vice in prison even, right?
Yeah, so there was this editor named Jesse Pearson from Vice, and this was way back in Vice, like early 2000s, when they were just basically like a magazine. I mean, they've grown as a company now. I mean, they're huge, but back then, they were kind of like this low-rent GQ. You know, they were kind of making a name for themselves, and he used to read Don Diva. Wow. So he wrote to me, and he's like, man, I want you to do a column. So I started doing this column for Vice from prison called I'm Busted. And then I went on, dude. I published like literally, dude, like hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of articles, like on the internet.
Wow.
You know, in print. You know, like I started writing for publication basically like 99.
Damn.
And so I didn't put out my first book until 2005. So like that 6 years, I'm just writing.
Okay. Building up content.
Yeah. And the other good thing about it too was, like I was getting paid, dude. Like Vice was paying me like $500 a month for basically like 800, 1200 words.
That's more than you could spend in prison.
Oh, dude, I was like, everybody thought I was a millionaire.
Yeah. Wow.
You know what I'm saying? You know, like there, yeah. There, you get like $500, man. You're like a millionaire.
Another cool thing about your story is, and that's, I think we'll get in there, is your wife opened up your LLC and you guys started a writing business from prison, correct? And she did your entire prison sentence with you.
Yeah,
and was one of the only ones to not tell the police where you were before, correct?
Yeah, so I met my wife probably about, maybe like 4 or 5 months before I got locked up. So I met her probably like early summer, spring
of, what a rider.
Of 93. And we started dating. But, you know, I mean, I was a player back then too. So, you know, I had like multiple girlfriends, you know, because I'm like, whatever. I was like Don Juan fucking hippie outlaw dude.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I mean, she was still like, we spent a lot of time together. So, you know, then whatever, she didn't even know my real name till the U.S. Marshals called her. And then, even on that second little run I had, like a lot of the dudes ended up snitching. And my wife always said she loved me from the first time she saw me, you know, and I'm not going to lie and say I loved her from the first time I saw her. You know, obviously I was interested in her or whatever, but, I think I really grew to love her when, you know, because she got arrested for aiding and abetting.
Wow.
You know, a fugitive. I mean, she didn't know I was a fugitive, but, you know, she knew I was an outlaw. She knew I was selling weed and shit like that. And then, like she didn't say nothing. You know what I'm saying? She was, like, one of the only people who, like, didn't snitch on me. And I think that's, like, when I really started falling in love with her. I was like, man.
Yeah. Wow.
Because you know, basically, like, everybody you do shit with, like, everybody basically, you know, but like I say, too, I mean, we were in the suburbs, whatever. Nobody came up. In that life, it's not like we were indoctrinated to the mafia or some shit like that. So, you know, what are you going to expect?
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, I blame myself for putting people in the position to snitch on me that, you know, couldn't hold their weight. You
yeah.
know, that was my fault. That was bad judgment call on me. So
you appointed the wrong person there, like
yeah.
we talk about.
Yeah, yeah. I put it on me. That was my failure, you know. And like I say, whatever, it's weed and LSD, that shit's all legal anyhow. So it should have been legal back then. But yeah, definitely my wife, man. She's a trooper. Did 21 years with me.
She's awesome. Shout out to Diane.
Yeah, shout out to Diane. Diane K. Schulte, now Ferrante. So we got married in prison in 2005 in the prison visiting room.
Okay.
Yeah, she used to, it was weird too, because it was like this, you know, because up until then, you know, like my mom was still doing a lot of stuff for me. And then it kind of got to the point where it was like they had like this transfer of power.
The handoff.
Yeah, it was like, take him. It's like, he's very demanding. Yeah. Even from prison, just take him. My wife, my mom was probably happy.
Your mom was happy to give you up, and Dan was happy to get you.
She was happy, you know, because I used to send a lot of orders from prison. You know,
oh, for sure.
Give me this, I need that. Because, you know, in there, like, you're helpless, dude. Like, you can't do shit.
And all you have in between those phone calls is to think about all the stuff you need.
When you got somebody that's actually willing to help you. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, in there, like, dude, mail calls, like, the highlight of the day. You know, shit's so fucking slow in there. You know, they wonder why everybody comes up with all these, you know, Machiavellian plans and stuff like that. It's because, like, you're bored to fucking death, dude. Yeah, you know, trying to figure out how to get drugs in, how to do this, how to do that, how to get in an unlocked cell, you know, whatever. You got a lot of time to think about that stuff so you can figure it out, you know, because it's so boring anyhow. It's like a challenge. But, yeah, so this girl, she basically facilitated and shepherded my writing career. When I decided I want to start putting out books, she... you know, she formed the publishing house, you know, figured all that stuff out, you know, on the business tip. And yeah, we started Guerrilla Convict. That's my publishing house and my website from prison in 2005. You know, me in there doing all the writing and the interviewing, and her out here kind of editing and doing the business and facilitating everything. Wow. You know, and us just kind of talking about it and visits and talking about it. You know, we couldn't even talk about it on the phone because... They kept trying to bust me, like, after I formed the publishing house. Even when I started writing for publication to get money, they were always trying to bust me for, like, running a business. Like, they were mad as fuck, dude.
Because money brings you power, and they don't want you to have that much money in there.
They were mad as fuck that I was making money. And then, but I pushed the envelope, too, because I started writing about stuff. I would never do stuff like what was shit that was going on, like, where I was at, because obviously you're not trying to get nobody jammed up.
Yeah.
But I would take, like, past instances, you know, that I knew about. And I would write about them, you know, kind of fictitious, not fictitiously, but I would kind of, you know, change names in the places, and I might make it seem like it's happening where I'm at.
Oh, so no matter what, they don't want you bringing
attention.
But
it's not like definitely saying where it's at, but I can make it appear like that as a writer, even though it's like something that might have happened 3 years before. And so then, the prison investigators, they used to get mad as fuck at me, dude, because they would say, like, somebody in Washington would, like, read something I wrote, and then, like, you know, shit goes downhill. So they would call the region people, then the region would call the warden at the prison, and the prison warden would, like, cuss out the investigators. So, dude, it was weird because I used to have, like, one-on-ones with these dudes. Like, they would fucking call me in, and I would, like, negotiate with them because I had a right to write. All the paperwork said I could write. But they just didn't like if I brought heat on them, you know. Like I got locked up, dude. I got locked up 20 times in SHU.
Wow, no way
for
that.
My writing, not for writing. Doing anything wrong, for my fucking writing.
For trying to better yourself.
For trying to better, and that's the way I looked at it. Because I told them, they'd be like, Ferrante, why don't you just stop? And I'd be like, man, fuck you. This is for my future. Why am I going to stop doing something for my future? I go, fuck this world. Yeah, I got to be here right now, but I'm not living in this world. I'm not staying in this world. I'm not coming back to this world.
That's right.
So do whatever the fuck you want to do to me. And a lot of times, dude, they put me in a hole and I would just write a book. With the little,
distractions.
The little fucking flimsy fucking pencil.
Golf pencils, yeah.
The little fucking rubber pencil that's like this fucking long, you know, on fucking pads of paper. And I would just fucking do that. But, yeah, but definitely, you know, you try to get the orderly in the SHU too. You know, give them 3 books of stamps, and sometimes they bring you a pen. Just the inside of the pen.
You got to make the outside with a piece of paper or tape. Yeah, for sure.
You would just get the inner sleeve with the ink.
You get that, and then you wrap up tape or piece of paper around it.
I would write books. I wrote like plenty of times. You know, like I did like 6 months in the hole before, like straight under investigation.
Damn.
And they would say bullshit like he was trying to smuggle drugs or. You know, he did this or he did that. And it's like, it's all for my writing. I wouldn't know because when they would come, you know how they do.
You,
like
know, when what, they, you know when they're coming.
You know like when they put you under investigation and they like leave you sitting there for like 30 days before they even come to see you.
Yep.
Then they come to see you and like they try to say it's for some bullshit. I would tell them straight up after I have to meet a couple times. I was like, man, I know this is for my writing. Why you guys, you know, what do you want? Tell me what you want.
Yeah.
You know?
So you actually finally hit the streets running then. I want to talk about, we got out about the same time. I think we got out a month apart because we're both out about 6 years now.
Yep.
And you're extremely successful. So what did you do right when you got out? You hit the streets running, and what were your plans?
Yeah, so I came out.
43 years old, right?
Yeah, I wanted to make film. That was my plan. You know, I mean, I was already working as a journalist in prison, so I continued that. You know, so my first 5 years, I made most of my money like through journalism.
Okay.
You know, like features and writing. So I did a ton of pieces, and I even got like, dude, like you know, Apple unveils new products, like I was a national journalist, dude. So like they would fly me in for that shit.
Wow.
You know, like Apple, and I would get flown. You know, like the publicists, they fly you in because they want you to write about them.
Yeah.
And then like when the cannabis stuff started kicking off, you know, 2015, 2016, they start flying me for all these cannabis events, you know, so I would write about them for Vice. So, but at the same time, you know, I'm doing film stuff. I did my first, it was kind of like my guerrilla film training. I did this little series called the Easter Bunny Assassin series, which it's like, it's an idea that came up in the prison. And I wrote the script. So it's just like, it's like four little 10 minute films, but it's kind of like this, fantastical kind of crime world mashup where you take like, you know, crime stuff, but then you take like somebody like the Easter Bunny assassin or the Tooth Fairy, you know, you make the Tooth Fairy into a mafia don.
Okay.
You know, you make like, you know, and I'm not trying to sound sacrilegious, but you know, we did like Jesus Christ Junkie. Mm-hmm. You know, that was like one of the characters, and we just have all these different characters, like a mashup. And I did these four little 10 minute films and put it up on YouTube. And that was kind of like how I trained myself, because I'd read a lot about how to make films. But immediately, dude, like the first summer I was out, I did that. You know, I kind of recruited, you know, crew like local guys, mostly college students.
Yeah.
You know, they would just like work for food or whatever and liked my idea.
Okay.
You know.
And then you got onto the movie White Boy, which was Rick, and you had met him in the federal prison, right?
No, I was never with Rick. Okay. We just wrote.
So, you knew each other's names or something?
Yeah, so I never met. I started writing Rick like 2005.
Okay.
Because, you know, I was doing the Street Legends book, so I was in a couple joints in West Virginia, and there was a lot of Detroit guys there.
Okay.
So I was already doing these Street Legends books, and I kept and writing these gangster stories for like Don D and other magazines. And I'm with all these Detroit dudes, and everybody's talking about this dude, White Boy Rick. And I'm like, who the fuck
is this dude? He's a legend in there, huh?
Yeah, who's this dude, White Boy Rick? But he's like, you know, I mean, he's a big legend, so he has as many supporters as he does detractors.
Haters, yeah.
So I'm like, who is this fucking white kid that was like allegedly like running the black underworld in mid-80s Detroit when he was a fucking teenager?
Yeah.
I'm like, who the fuck is this dude, right? So I started writing him because I wanted to put him in my Street Legends book.
Okay.
But he started telling me this story like through letters that it didn't kind of vibe with what I was doing, because I was kind of doing like the Jesse James, Billy the Kid stuff. You know, I was like romanticizing these dudes, kind of like how gangster rap does. That was kind of my thing. You know, when I first started writing, you know, I was taking these African-American drug lords and turning them into these, you know, Wild West type figures. And, you know, I used to write all like within the code, you know, like Death Before Dishonor, you know, it was all about that. And so Rick started telling me his story, you know, about being an informant when he was 14 and being pimped out by the feds, you know, and made into a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And then fucked over and left for dead.
Straight up.
And, you know, at the time when I first started writing him, you know, that didn't vibe with my mentality because, you know, when you're in prison, I mean, you're not going to be by a fucking snitch or informant when you're in fucking prison. That's like,
yeah,
you know, that shit might rub off on you. And somebody's calling you a snitch or informant. 100%. You got to go fucking kill somebody or something.
And they'll make you go get him yourself.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, so, but as I matured as a person and as I matured as a writer, I say my writing kind of changed because, you know, after I'd been in, you know, like over a decade, you know what I'm saying? And going into like, you know, into 20 years, I started seeing the system for what it is. How really, you know, you can say whatever. I mean, somebody's a snitch or there's not a snitch. But I mean, it's a system, the way the system's set up. The reason back in the day why you didn't have as many snitches because dudes were only facing like 3 to 5 years when they did something. You know, now when the feds come in all the states and they do all this tough on law, you know, 85% and motherfuckers are facing like 10, 20 years for some fucking bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what fucking created snitches. So, you know, I kind of started blaming the system, you know, and the way stuff was set up and the way the laws were set up. And I always tell people this, like, our criminal justice system and our prison systems, they're corrupt. And when I say they're corrupt, I mean, there are some corrupt guards here and there, but it's not like, you know, most of the people working in the prison, most of the people working in the criminal justice system, they are not corrupt.
For sure.
Yeah. Individually.
Yeah.
Although there are some here and there.
Of course.
But they are, the whole system is corrupt. You know, the way it targets, you know, and processes people. And so once I started seeing that, my writing and my mentality kind of evolved. And then I could start seeing Rick's story, because it took me like for 5 years, I couldn't even write Rick's story.
Wow.
Because just my mentality, because I was like hardcore. I was like in prison, man. You got to adapt that mindset in there, mm-hmm. that convict mentality, you know, to survive and thrive in there. You know what I'm saying?
Brainwash yourself to that bullshit, too.
Because, you know, like I'm saying, you know, if somebody's this, if somebody's that, I mean, you can be a dude you're hanging out with, and then, like, some paperwork comes out on the fucking dude, and you might even like the dude, but then you got to go fucking smash him off fucking mainline. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's like, so you got to be real guarded in there. You know, and then it's the same thing, like your own people, if they see chinks in your armor, they'll try to start trying to put some shit in the game with you, you know, to fucking get you on a bus ride or get you out of here or whatever. So it's just a fucked up game that we have to play when we're in there, man. And so as I kind of evolved, and also, you know, I did 12 years in the gladiator schools, and then like my level dropped because I got in trouble. So my last 9 years were in Lowe's. And dude, the lows are just like,
chill, huh?
Once you did like 12 years in the medium, the lows, it's like a cakewalk. It's like, cause you know, in prison, if you got like over a decade in, that's like stripes on your fucking arm.
For sure. That's
so you get up to the lows and you see the people that coming up for camps or the, you know, most of the dudes are fucking snitches there anyhow. Mm-hmm. And you see the dudes, they got like 3 to 5 years. It's like, they're looking to you for like leadership.
What up, OG?
You know, so it was like, even when I was in those lows, like a lot of times I was the type of dude, cause I fuck with everybody. So I would just try to help. You know, I was real diplomatic. I would try to smooth shit over. And two, you know, I'm white. So I would try to, you know, look out for the white boys, make sure they didn't get in trouble, shit like that. But never like I was a shot caller. I was more like like the diplomat problem solver type of dude in there.
Well, I always say everybody has their own roles. You know what I'm saying? Not everybody can be the shot caller. Not everybody can do what you did. So, I mean, there's a lot of dudes that use, whether it's a drug addiction or prison or something, as an excuse that they can't make something of themselves. You know, we're clearly both examples that you can do whatever the fuck you want in your life as long as you make the right change and put in the work to get to where you want to go. So, lastly, I kind of want you to talk about this to give the people some motivation. You know, like, what is life like now for Seth Ferranti? I know you got a bunch of big projects that you're working on and launching soon. So I'm going to kidnap you and the wife and make you guys come back and do a follow-up once your projects start dropping. But how's life right now and what do you got going on?
Yeah, man. I mean, shit's going pretty good. I'm doing what I want. You know, I'm traveling a lot. I'm
ski all the damn stuff. Time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you got to take the little advantages in life. But definitely, man, I'm working. And I used to be like a big, you know, supporter. Like I'd be like, you know, work hard, grind. But now, you know, I'm kind of getting to the point where I'm like, you know what? I'm like,
enjoy life.
Enjoy life, but work smart.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
So I've gotten to the level where, you know, I got a lot of my projects funded, but you know, still, I think this next year for me, as this stuff comes out, this is kind of like the make or break year for me. All this stuff I got funded, all this stuff I got coming out, you know, it's either going to hit or miss, you know? So if I want to keep doing this stuff, you know, it's going to have to hit, or I'm going to have to get a few hits. You know, you can't get a hit on everything, you know, but,
you got to bet on yourself.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, yeah, I always told people, you know, before I was doing a lot of traveling, you know, I was like, I just want to work, travel for my work, like all the time. And now I'm actually doing it. I've been doing it, you know, since probably last June. And now I'm like, I just want to like a fucking week at home, man. I'm like, give me 5 days at home just to do nothing.
Yeah, chill with the dogs.
Yeah. So, you know, it's weird because, you know, I talk about with my wife all the time too. Like you see how like you see the big stars and it's like they get exhaustion and they have to go in some, you know, exhaustion rehab or whatever. And I was just thinking like, what the fuck, man? Like you're living the life.
You're flying.
You know, now I can see like traveling all the time. Like, especially if you, you know, I mean, me myself, I'm not a big drug user. You know, I like a little psychedelics and weed, maybe a little alcohol, but I'm not a really big drug guy. But I can see if you're like young and you're partying and you're doing a lot of drugs and you got all these schedules to meet, yeah, you can fucking get exhausted, man. And fucking, you know, cause yeah, it's tiring, man. You know, traveling and working and doing events and shit.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you guys all for listening here. Seth has, like I said, a crazy ass story, the complete opposite of mine, and just shows that everybody has their own route to everything. Anybody can be successful. So I hope we drop some game to you guys and let you guys know. Chase your dream. Just go get it. No one's stopping you. Seth, thank you again for coming here. Diane, thank you so much for holding it down for him so he could be here. And
yeah, she's my sanity.
Absolutely. So appreciate you guys for listening. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us some feedback. We would love to know what you think. You can find everything discussed in this episode and more in our show notes below or petermeyerhoff.com. I am Peter Meyerhoff, and you've been listening to the Roll Call with Chappie podcast.